Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 247. This week's podcast once again takes us back into my Celtic life, with St Anthony interviewing a Celtic great of the past. And the question is it a Celtic great, or is it a Celtic could have been great, or maybe could have been another Paddy McCourt? Who knows? Because it's Mr Andy Ritchie, famous to football fans of the early 80s as the player who perhaps didn't espouse the modern football ethos of someone like Ronnie Dyler. And again, there's a bit of mythology about him because the lack of TV coverage meant that there was only the odd glimpse of him in a Morton jersey or if you saw him in real life. It's Mr. Andy Lynch, who started his career at Celtic under Jock Stein, fell out with him, moved on to Morton in a part swap deal with Roy Baines and became a Morton legend before returning to the club as a scout. And I can remember him being in goals for a Knowles house party thing at Celtic Park. Anyway, enough of me. This week I'm going to tell you about the Celtic FC Foundation stuff at the end of the podcast. So this is him, St Anthony, with him, Andy Ritchie. Oh, and before we start, St Anthony's chat is so long that I decided it would be better to break it down into two podcasts. So today's podcast, just under an hour long, it's part A of the Andy Ritchie anthology, and part B will be up in a few days' time.
It's my pleasure tonight to be joined by Andy Ritchie. Andy, the famous ex-Celtic and Morton player who is regarded as a legend around the areas of Scottish football, and we're going to have a wee chat with him in the normal course of manner about his career. So first thing as always, Andy, what was your first game and who was your first football hero?
My first game would probably be about the age of about 7 or 8. My father was a big Motherwell supporter for the Belsall area here. So he took me to my first game there. I'd be telling you a lie if I remembered what game it was, you know. But as I say, I'd be about 7 or 8, so that would be about the early 60s. And Mullow had a very good team at that time, a lot of good players in the team. Ian St John had just left at that time. But I remember, you know, watching the game at Mullow in the early stages and being really impressed by a guy called Willie Hunter, who went on to play down south for Portsmouth and one or two other English teams. It would have been termed as being an old inside left, and for the modern day people, you know, it's a wee bit like the number 10 role now that they play in football. But he had fantastic ability, played for Scotland as well, great ability, and was just an out-and-out football player. He was a joy to watch, and I remember my early stages with my dad getting a lot of pleasure, even at that early age, watching a really good football player.
So you were a bit of a schoolboy prodigy, and as a 16-year-old, but there was all sorts of teams chasing you. So why did you choose Celtic above it? Well, firstly, what teams were after you and why did you choose Celtic?
A schoolboy prodigy would probably be a wee bit wrong there in the respect that, you know, I never played for the local teams at the school or for the Lanarkshire team, and I certainly was never a Scottish schoolboy internationalist. What you could maybe describe at that time as being a slow burner. I was a bit bigger than the rest of the boys, so I stood out a wee bit more, but I wouldn't have said that. My first game was by chance. I'd played for the local YMCA team here, and at that time the English clubs were coming up and holding trials up here. They were scouting Scotland really hard at that time because there was a multitude of very good football players down in England at that time, and they wanted to try and get them up here in Scotland as early as they could. So a gentleman who run the local team here, one of the boys never turned up to go for the trial. It was a Sunday afternoon in Cumbernauld, and he lived locally here with me, and he came and chapped the door and spoke to my dad and asked if I would come to make up the numbers. And I did. My dad says to me, "Away you go, Moody, in here." that man's good to you. He gives you a game on a Saturday and, you know, he makes sure you get him all right and that, so you go and do that. So I went to Cumbernauld, to the old Cumbernauld Juniors Park, and it was for Middlesbrough. And at that time, their manager was a guy called Stan Anderson. He was assisted by Harold Shepherdson, who was Sir Alf Ramsey's
English coach,
assistant in the national team at that time as well. They held the trials up there, and I got a game. They started me, and I played 20 minutes of the game, and then I got substituted. And I thought, well, there goes a promising football career, you know. What I was actually thinking was maybe they'll give me my expenses for going to Cumbernauld and I'll get a pound out of it, you know. little did I know until well after that they spoke to me after the game and invited me to come to Middlesbrough, me and my family, my mum and my dad, for a week to see if we liked the place and see how we were going to do as a bit of an extension to the trial, which I automatically agreed to, as you can well imagine, a 13, 14-year-old boy getting the chance like that, and it was to be arranged, that would be about the November, and it to be arranged over the Christmas holidays, so I was off school. I went out into the car park, and a gentleman approached me, and it was Jimmy Matthew, so Matt Busby's brother, and he invited myself and my family down to Manchester United. I got to the car, the gentleman that took us up, and the Celtic scout John Dempsey was there at the car, inviting me to train it. Celtic Park, and to come in the following Tuesday, they would like to speak to me. By the time I got in the car, my head was buzzing for Cumbernauld down to Bells Hill. And when I got back in here to my home here at 35 Warnock Crescent, the Rangers scout was sitting talking to my mum and dad. So within the space of an afternoon, I ended up training at Celtic Park on a Tuesday night and Ibrox on a Thursday night, which during the early 70s, people can well imagine it was an unusual situation.
Who'd have been a manager at Ibrox at the time would have been Waddle?
Yeah, Willie Waddle. The guy who looked after the situation at that time was another gentleman called Stan Anderson, who was going to manage Clyde. But I trained there on a Tuesday at Celtic and Rangers on a Thursday. I went to Middlesbrough with my family. I went to Manchester. I could have gone West Brom, Coventry, all the teams that were running about at that time. It became a wee bit of an avalanche after that, you know. I'd went down twice to Middlesbrough, and actually in the second time was with a guy called Tony McAndrew.
Oh, he became a big centre-half,
didn't he? He did, he played for Middlesbrough and Chelsea, and he's now on the coaching staff at Aston Villa. And we went down there together, and I'd more or less promised at that time, when the school was over, that I would go to Middlesbrough. But when I come back up the road, I was still training at Celtic Park, and after about a fortnight of that, I changed my mind, I wanted to go to Celtic. With some great coaches in it at that time, you know, Willie Fernie, people like that who looked after the boys at that time, and I was beginning to get comfortable with the situation at Celtic, and I was beginning to think twice about, as a 15-year-old boy making the long journey down to Middlesbrough on me, and I felt maybe I was too young for that.
So would Jock Stein have spoke to you at that point to try to get you to sign for Celtic, or was it all left to the...
Aye, well, they'd brought my father in. We'd spoken together, and Celtic had spoken and said that they would like to sign me. They'd like to sign. We could sign S forms up here at that time, schoolboy form, but the English clubs couldn't do that. So Celtic had offered me an S form, and Rangers had offered me, and Rangers, in a polite manner, had said to me that I would have to make my mind up pretty quickly, because it was an unusual situation for allowing a boy to train at Celtic and train at Rangers as well, you know. And after a lot of thought and deliberation, looking at the situation, Celtic had the best boys' system in the country. They had the best of the international school boys, and a couple of nights like that, and they were prepared to offer them the situation to move into Celtic Boys Club after that, and for me to stay at home. And the manager had spoken quite comprehensively to my father about that, and I had made pals at Celtic Park as well.
Who would your pals have been in? Tommy.
Tommy was there at the time. Tommy was only young at the time. There were other boys there, like Joe McKee, who came from Bridgeton, who was there on the Brad Prentice.
Joe McKee?
Yeah.
Joe McKee's daughters weren't with me, that's funny. And then they actually said one day that they're quite modest about their dad. Is it Celtic? Is Joe McKee, young Joe McKee, is at Morton?
That's right.
So yeah. He is.
He was a kid the last time I seen him.
So when I get to Morton tomorrow, they'll be delighted to hear that, you know, because yeah. My dad's a nice guy.
I became very friendly with Joe at that time. And I, as I said before, I was beginning to get comfortable with the place. I didn't come from a Celtic background, but the football was the most important thing. That was paramount to Celtic. You know, the rest of the stuff that went on was merely a distraction at that time. If you were 13, 14 and 15, nothing out with football was ever mentioned. And that suited as well.
So when you actually signed for Celtic, then...
Signed as a schoolboy. And then I was leaving school and I got a job with a mining company out here and happened to say one day to Sean Fallon that I don't think I was really cut out for going down the pit. And he mentioned to the manager, and the manager offered me a place on the ground staff, which was, you know, the top of the tree as far as a 15-year-old boy was concerned, you know, to go to Celtic Park every morning and you know, start your footballing education rather than be two nights a week and a Saturday. And to be round about the greats at Celtic Park, even though you were only...
I was going to bring that up there. I mean, so this would have been the era that some of the Lions would still have been there. Dalglish and McGrain would have been at their peak. Davy Hay, that kind of thing. It must have been a great education for a young boy to be around there, guys.
Fantastic. Fantastic it was. Just to be there, you know, round about. Our tasks early on in that, you know, everybody thinks it's a glamorous lifestyle on that team, but it wasn't. What we were doing was we were providing for them, i.e. as in training gear and tidying up and cleaning the dressing rooms and cleaning the toilets and brushing down the terraces after the game had finished. But in the mornings, you know, when these guys were coming in, the full-timers and the first team were coming in, you were there to look after them, you know, and that was great as well, you know, just to...
So how did you find Jock Steen at that point? Was he good with the young boys?
He was fantastic with the young boys, aye. But he didn't really get involved as much as a lot of people would have thought, you know. He was mere first team and first team stroke reserves rather than the kids. As I said, at that time, they had really good people in there at Celtic Park. Neely Mokin, Wally Fernie. That was their responsibility to look after them. And then going down through the system, you know, they had coaches at Celtic Boys Club and that to do the bits and bobs of the footballing game. But you were learning your trade at Celtic Park. You know, some mornings Big Joke would come in and say, you know, come along to Barrowfield this morning, you know, bring your boots with you, you know, and you couldn't get along there quick enough, you know, because basically, if you didn't say that, you were either behind the goals collecting the balls for people or running about doing chores. But if you could get at 16 out to Barrowfield in the morning, and especially with the first team, you know.
Do you know, I think we've lost something about the reserve football under the bye, you know.
Aye.
Oh, because like, they've got this development thing now, and people, I think, might not understand that. I remember being a boy, and say Celtic were playing Aberdeen at Parkhead, the reserves would play the corresponding fixture at Pittodrie that day.
That's right.
And my dad used to send me for an Evening Times, and the first time he looked at it was what was the score of the reserves. And then the Celtic, he would come out on a Wednesday, and you would always keep a wee eye out, Sean Fallon, I call him. And he would never be too... He would never
glow about people.
No, he never... But you could read between the lines, you know. Like if they beat, say... On D5, nothing, and Ritchie scored three, Burns get one, and George McCluskey get one, you would think these guys must be good. And you gradually got to know the names as you got older and played more games, and then you might get a wee called into the squad, but not get a game, but you were, as I said, you're always round about it. And I think reserve football is something that's badly missed.
Well, I think so as well. You know, I think the modern day youth system thing seems to have came out of what's probably been a very good idea, but it didn't have the longevity that something like the reserves. Because, you know, some of these boys come through the system for their 14, and by the time they get to 19, they've played against all the same players in their age group for 5 years.
Steen was a great guy for bringing an experienced man, putting him in amongst the boys, and letting the boys learn from him.
Well, we had guys like Harry Hood, Big Tid Callaghan, Jim Brogan.
Great professionals.
Yeah, and also as well, the guys who didn't play in the first team on the Saturday, if there was a midweek game in the reserves, they played with the
fringe
reserves.
Players.
That's right, the modern way of looking at it now is they ask whether they would like to play any games. You know, if you weren't in the first team, you played with the reserves. If you didn't play, it didn't matter if you played 30 games before. If you had missed the previous Saturday's game and you were fit enough to play, you were included in the reserve team squad. And, you know, the pinnacle of a young player at that time was to try and make the reserve team squad.
Mm-hmm.
There was no youth team.
No.
You went out to a junior club and you went in to work and to play with men. You know, at 16 they decided you were no longer going to be a boy. You were going to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you got through the junior system, if you were lucky, I went out to Rob Roy in the August and was lucky enough to get called up with the Scottish youth team while I was still playing at Rob Roy.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, Celtic took me on in the January. So I only played half a season in junior. And I'd played about half a dozen reserve games before that.
Mm.
But the reserve games was the start of your real education. You know, wee Jimmy was back there and wasn't he playing regular in the first team at that time? And Jimmy would come and play. I remember going to Arbroath one day and playing. And me and a fella, Brian McLaughlin, who passed away there a couple of years ago. Brian was the main protege at Celtic at that time.
He was a standout, wasn't he?
You know, all things being equal, and if he'd been given a fair wind at his back, he'd have been up there with the Celtic greats, Brian McLaughlin. And he was a year older than me. And I remember we went to Arbroath together, and it was quite a long journey, I remember, at that time, coming back from Arbroath. It wasn't all the new motorways. Mm-hmm. And we spoke all the way in the bus, all the way from Gayfield and Arbroath to Celtic Park about wee Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
He did everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a fullback playing at Arbroath at that time, who I got to know pretty well after that, early years, a guy called Cammy Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And Cammy didn't know whether his back passage was bored or screwed to the end of the game, you know. Jimmy just put on a display that he just marvelled at. Me and Brian spoke about it all the way, and what about when he did this, and what about when he did that?
Mm-hmm.
The man was a magician, a genius, you know.
It's funny you mentioned Brian McLaughlin there. I remember seeing photos when I was a boy in the newspapers when I first started taking an interest in football. And it was you and Brian playing Scotland Pro Youth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he's had Blazers on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a couple of Rangers players. There was one called, they never made it, one called Donaldson.
George Donaldson. He went to
West Brom. And Parlin might have been there. I don't know if he was there. But anyway, the used to guys were seen as the pick of the bunch, if we can put it like that.
Mm.
And there was a older Celtic fans, my dad included, said that Steen had a plan, that when the Lions sort of came to the end of their natural existence,
mm-hmm,
then the likes of you and Brian McLaughlin, Tommy Burns, Roy Aitken and George McCluskey were the new breed that were going to get right in there.
Mm-hmm.
So did you feel that, were you confident of making the breakthrough at that point?
Oh, I was, you know, I was always confident that given a fair crack of the whip, it would be okay, you know. You can never, you always have self-doubt. Everybody does. It's, you know, you've self-doubt as an old man, you'll have a lot more self-doubt as a young one. But the task had been laid out in front of me, it had been spoken to me enough at Celtic Park, what was to be done to achieve. And I never felt at any time that through that spell that I wouldn't, because things happened pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I'd only spent a 6 month at Rob Roy, and I thereafter became a regular in the reserve team, which was, as I said before, the pinnacle.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a regular there, and I played in the first team at 17.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that had, out with Brian McLaughlin, who was reckoned to be the best, that had never happened to boys before. Kenny was 21 before he played.
Danny McGrain was...
No, but it was just something that didn't happen in the system at that time. It took you to 20 if you were still there at Celtic. In fact, I played in the reserve team with guys at 28 and never played a first team game. Ward White, one or two other guys at that time.
Stevie Hancock.
Rab Prentice hadn't played. Rab was 4 years older than me and he wasn't in the first team, you know. So going in and being given the opportunity at that time to play, to make your debut, and at that time, that would be the early 70s. You know, to make your debut, come on as a substitute, and Big Joke took Big Billy off that day to put me on. And you could hear a great intake of breath round about Celtic Park, that Celtic's greatest ever captain was getting substituted for a 17-year-old boy. As if to say, well, we'll wait and see what this guy's like, you know.
So by the time we got to 75, you're hammering away the door in the reserves, some great displays in the reserves. And Jock is a car crash. So Sean took over for the season, and you played quite a lot of games under Sean. So do you think Sean took a shine to you, or was it just a case of an actual progression that you were ready?
I don't know whether, frankly, say Sean was ever totally convinced that I was going to be a player at Celtic. So I did play mere games with Sean, and I did with Big Joke, just due to the circumstances of the car crash. But he had also signed players as well, centre forwards, you know, to come in at that time. And they sort of, because they were signed players and it cost money, moved up the pecking order in front of me, which I wasn't happy about. And, you know, I found my opportunities in the first team a lot more limited. And because of that, the players, they trained three centre forwards. Because of that, my opportunities in the reserve become a wee bit limited as well. And around about that time, I developed a horrible attitude for the fact that I'd been able to get through the system this far. And they were bringing in players at that time in front of myself. And I spent probably a horrible year, 18 months like that. The guys they brought in didn't last long. But in the intervening time, I was getting itchy feet with the whole thing because I wasn't playing football. And that's all you wanted to do at that time. You know,
do you remember a game against Leeds in 76? Again, for the people who are listening, Leeds, a couple of months before that, had been in the European Cup final. He'd been beat by Bayern Munich.
That's right.
So arguably the second best team in Europe. Full of guys like Lorimer and Eddie Gray, Joe Jordan, Gordon McQueen, Norman Hunter, like everyone in my household name. So they come up to Parkhead one winter's night to play a friendly, and you scored the goal that made the headlines. You beat about three of them and fired a one for about 20 yards.
I remember the game. Leeds had went out in the early rounds of the European Cup at that time, and Celtic had went out in the early rounds as well. Massive crowd at Celtic Park, and they had the Giles.
They had a yellow strip on that night, remember that?
Gary Sprakin goals, Paul Madeley, Norman Hunter, Eddie Gray.
So that was an indication of what you had in your locker. And yet, Sean, for whatever reason, you know, after that, you faded away again. And Jock comes back for the car crash and takes charge. And yet, within a matter of months, you're out the door. So what happens?
At that time, I had played for a while at Celtic Park, and they gave me a game that night. And I played very well in the first half. Scored a goal, and thought I'd done very well. And I came in at half-time, and Sean took me off.
Is this a Leeds game?
Nah.
I never realised that.
I never played the second half. He took me off.
Did he get a
reason? I complained about it at the time. And made the fatal mistake, one of probably many at that time. I left Celtic Park 5 minutes into the second half and went home. And, you know, obviously I was drawn over the coals in the morning after that. I wasn't happy with the fact that I hadn't got to play. George McCluskey substituted for me that night. I don't know whether maybe Sean had explained what he was trying to do or what have you, but I just felt that after leaving me out and no playing in the reserve and doing whatever, he had slighted me very badly. You know, when I look back at it now, I was too young to have thought like that, you know. I may very well have had the body and the attitude of a man at that time, but I was still only 17, you know. And when I look back, as I say, I made some wrong decisions, and that was one of them at that time, which didn't help, you know, knocked me further back in the pecking order.
So when the end came at Celtic, were you surprised to be shown the door, or was it something that you half thought, I've got one foot out of the door here?
Willie McLean was manager at Motherwell at the time, and George Miller was manager at Falkirk, and both of them had made bids for me at the summer that year. Big Joke had tried to do a swap deal to bring a guy called Bobby Graham, who was one of the top players in Scotland for Motherwell at that time, and they wanted to do a swap deal for me to go to Motherwell. Motherwell didn't want that. They wanted money as well. So there'd been one or two wee things flying about. So I had talks during that spell with Big Joke about that, you know, and that had made me even more unsettled. And we had a few fallouts about it. Too much to say for myself, you know. I stated once or twice that at 17, if I had attained the cotton wool out of my ears and stuck it in my mouth, it might very well have done me a better turn at that time. But we'd got to the stage where we were beginning to butt heads a wee bit, you know.
Mm.
And I found out after I was beginning to really frustrate him, something terrible. And his general health hadn't been as good as it was prior to the accident, so he wasn't really the same man after that.
Mm.
His patience wasn't as good, and there was a lot of other things in his personality that changed because of a near-death accident like that, which I can recognise now as being an older person.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd spoke about it a couple of times, and then my wife used to work in Canvas Lang, and Benny Rooney's wife used to work in Canvas Lang, and we used to meet each other in the mornings dropping
the leaf off.
Mm-hmm. We got blathering, and then one day at home, Big Joke phoned me and said that Morton wanted to sign me. They wanted the Morton goalkeeper, Celtic, a guy called Roy Baines.
Right.
And if I wanted to speak any more about it, to get my big fat backside out of my bed and get to Celtic Park the next hour,
mm-hmm.
which I did. And Hal Stewart was there with Benny, and Celtic were keen on doing the deal, and they allowed Morton to speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a conversation about it along a London road at Joe's Kitchen.
Were you and Jock?
No, me and Hal.
Oh, you and Hal, sorry.
One of many conversations. He said what he wanted to do, and I'd play regular, and I would do this, and I would do that. And Hal was a fantastic salesman, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He'd have been a great agent nowadays, you know. He could sell, you know, snow to the Eskimos. He was just that way inclined. And I came back to Celtic Park again after speaking to them, and Big Joke took me into the boardroom. And he said to me, he says, "What? They've offered me terms, I'm thinking about it." And I'll never forget, he said to me, "Why would you want to go to that elephant's graveyard?" And I said, "Well, because I'm not getting a game here." He says, "Well, hold on." And he called John Clark, who's still at Celtic Park, one of the great Lisbon Lions.
He was a reserve guy at the time, actually.
He was in the coaching staff, to come along. And we sat together in the boardroom, the three of us. And Big Joke said to John, and John said, "Well, if Andy wants to stay here and put the necessary work in and make the performances in, I'll certainly play him in the reserve team. There'll not be a problem." Joke says, "Well, your contract's up. We'll give you another 4-year contract if you want to sign it right now. It's up to yourself on the same terms that you had before with everything else. You've got to decide." And I made probably the worst decision of my life. Footballing life, sorry. Mm-hmm. I decided, for whatever reason at that moment, to go to Morton.
Well, what do you think? I mean, he sent you down there to speak to Morton, right? And so what do you think is going through his mind? He's almost like forcing your arm, if you like, and then it hits you with this.
He's testing the water with you. That's he's testing the water to see how committed you are to sign here, to fight for your place, to do the things that you were doing before that you should still be doing now. It was a tester.
What was his reaction when you said you were going to Morton?
I'll never forget, he stood up. There was a massive big boardroom table at Celtic Park, and he stood up and he had massive legs on the table underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Big Joke always had a wee bit of a gammy knee. Mm-hmm. As he got up, he bumped his knee off the bottom of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I tell him I was going to Morton, off the bottom of the table. And he cursed about half a dozen times, stormed out and slammed the door.
Mm-hmm.
But
the argument is, if he really wanted to keep you, he'd just have said you're not going.
He could have, but I think the tester was that he wanted me to tell him.
So you failed the test.
That I was staying here,
right.
And the 4-year contract I was taking up, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't be able to keep me at the team. You know, that's what he was expecting from me, and I wasn't mature enough to do that.
I remember when you went to Morton, not with the first division team at the time, which was the second round at that level. You know, that was the Premier League. So you were dropping down the league, and people were saying that you were too good a player for that. You were still a Premier League player. And you should be playing for a Premier League team. Now, Pat McCluskey, I heard Pat McCluskey say one night, he ended up with Dumbarton, similar to yourself, dropping down the division. And he says, "I found out in later years that Newcastle and Norwich, who were fairly middling English teams at the time in the top division, had made bids for Pat McCluskey, but Jock said no." It was almost as if he didn't want you to succeed when you left.
Yeah, there's been a lot of guys who have made that point over the years, you know.
It's almost as if I fire him down to Morton, they're part-time, they're a division below us, he'll just disappear into sort of that a bit.
I suppose, you know, Joke Steen was human like everybody else, so we all have an ego of some sort, and maybe the fact that people were maybe going on to make a career for themselves, make a good footballing life for themselves, and proved to be a success was maybe looked upon as being a black mark against him. In his own mind, it wouldn't have been in anybody else's mind, but maybe in his own mind, you know, being the perfectionist that he was, everything had to be 100%. You had to be 100% right or 100% wrong. So I could see maybe the point of that, that he'd maybe feel that. Yeah, and that's maybe where the phraseology down to that elephant's graveyard was concerned, you know. Yeah, I don't really want you to go there because we'll not see you again. But at the same time, it wasn't, I knew after it that he wasn't getting the response that he wanted for me, and that was my fault. That was the mistake that I made, that I had to live with for the rest of my life, you know.
So you ended up going to Crapo, and it was an adventure, there's no doubt about it. So the first season, first full season you were there, they won promotion in a tight league, and that was an achievement at that time. And Benny Rooney definitely had something going, and he was building it around about you. You were the main man, you were the goal scorer, the sort of the leading light on the park. So in the 78-79, you were a top scorer, you ended up player of the year. And you were valued at one point at the 200,000 mark. Now, that's a lot of money back then, an awful lot of money. Did nobody come in to take you down south at that point, when you were at your peak at Morton?
Jackie Charlton offered 175,000 at Sheffield Wednesday for me, who were, prior to the Premiership, a First Division team.
And they were one below.
Liverpool had been looking to make an offer. Celtic had come back again.
Really?
Which I'd found out
under
Big Not still with Big Joke at the time. I'd only been down there 5.5 months. And
it's a pity he didn't put you in loan.
Yeah. It would have been better for me anyway, I know that much. You know, I remember we went to play the second game I played for Morton, we went to play Alec Ferguson, St Mirren at Love Street, which was a local derby and a big thing for Morton and St Mirren. Good crowd and everything else, and we get beat stuffed 5-1. I'd scored that day, but I remember driving home in the motor thinking, I made a big mistake here. I've made a big, big mistake. I don't really want to be hanging about here too long. And if it had been possible, I would have bypassed going to training the Monday morning at Capital and just went straight back into Celtic Park if I could have done it. But it was too late, it was a cry by that time. And I remember Sean coming down about 5 months after it, because I did a good start. Morton, when I went down, they were second bottom in that first division, and we'd won a few games, I'd scored a few goals, and, you know, people were beginning to take a bit of notice again, and, you know, Sean had said to Morton that they would give them £65,000 if they would just let me come back to Celtic Park, and more or less, it was a loan deal, and they were calling the loan back in again. But the guy I spoke about before, Hal Stewart, obviously seen that you could maybe get more money. Because basically at that time, a player was only a slave to a football club.
This is before freedom of contract,
this was
wasn't
before
it?
Bosman, before all that. Once you signed for that football club, regardless of whether you wanted to stay, you wanted to go, made no difference. The club held your registration for the rest of your career. And they had to make a decision whether you were going or not. You just didn't even do that, you didn't think about it. You were in their hands, they told you what you were doing.
And all this that you were achieving at the time, Morton were a part-time team?
Yeah. I'd went back, I'd got a job working in the meat market in Glasgow, delivering butcher meat to butcher shops. So I was up at 6 o'clock in the morning doing that, and then down to training for early season, three times a week. But we were training at night time, we were all part-time. That was a bit of a culture.
That would have been difficult, wouldn't it?
Especially when you come. And you're going, with all due respect, you're going to Capello in that. There is at Celtic Park, you had all the attributes thrown about you for it to be a football player. You know, you were turning up for training at Capello, and if you didn't get in early, you ended up training with an orange and a yellow soak. You know, that you were only doing early, you didn't get the best of the gear. If you were in too late after it, there were no hot water. You know, that was a bit of a culture shock for me coming from Celtic Park like that. And three nights a week and having to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And you know, if I was playing the Wednesday night, you know, don't tell the people at the meat market you're not coming in for your work. You know, I still had to be there till 5 o'clock and then just leave straight. And that was again before all the motorways were built. So we had to drive through weird and wonderful places like Renfrew to get to Greenock.
Aye, aye.
So all these things were there. So it was a massive shock. And I was just married and had a young family at that time as well. So
you must have been drained.
It was difficult.
Physically.
Aye. Mm-hmm. But when you're 20, you're young. You know, you can put up with these type of things and go on with it. And I wanted to play football. I wanted to be a success. Whatever success was going to mean. I just wanted to play football because there was no other way to be a success other than play and score goals. I thought that if I played well and scored goals for Morton, I would get a move to a bigger and better club. That was what the sole context of the thing was. It was the money.
I wrote a book recently about the 78-79 season. Celtic won the league in the last game of the season, 4-2 with 10 men. And I catalogued it through each game. And obviously Celtic played Morton four times that season.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was one night, March 79, and I'll never forget this. Celtic played in a sort of green, almost like a Scotland strip, with a bit of diamonds doing it. Mm-hmm. Very popular at the time. And you scored a goal that night for about 40 yards in the jungle side.
Mm-hmm.
And it got disallowed.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, you know, I've heard people, anybody who was ever at that game, and there wasn't a big crowd there that night, but there'd been maybe between 15,000-20,000.
Mm-hmm.
Talks about that goal, and all they can, nobody remembers who scored for Celtic, but they cannot tell you about your goal.
People that were at that game still mention that to me, aye. You know, the way things are, the nutty, you know, you probably, the Morton supporters could have called it a conspiracy, you know, a bad refereeing decision or whatever it was. No, Jimmy Tolmie was seemingly flagged for being offside.
Another side of the park.
On the other side of the park, away across our side. In fact, when I went back to Celtic Park to work, one of the goalkeeping coaches in there was Peter Latchford, and he was in goals that night.
That's right.
And Peter used to go to bed and have nightmares about that, you know. He says, you destroyed Alan Ruff, and now you're in the process of trying to destroy me as well, you know.
Because you get a bit of a rough time after Jungle at the time, like Celtic Reject and that kind of thing. Good nature stuff, it's got to be said. And I actually remember a Jungle Boo that night. The lightning was a jungle side, and he got dogs abuse. Because people appreciated that you just saw something that night that you might never see again. It was a magnificent goal.
I remember that
opening
day.
Shot, dipped right in the top corner.
The opening day of the season when we played Celtic, Morton played in the orange and blue strips. Celtic obviously in the hoops that day. And it was a sellout. Capello was full, we couldn't get another body in the place. And I remember coming out for the warm-up of it. We warmed up at 10-3 at that time, you know. I remember coming out for the warm-up, the place was full. The Celtic supporters were in and en masse, and they were giving me pelters as they come out with this orange and blue strip on and reject. And I remember just looking there and putting my thumb up. That was all. Just put my thumb up to them like that, gave them a wave. And you could actually see people's faces change, you know, for the growl, and you know, it's just a mass of faces there, and you can see people's faces sort of laughing a bit to themselves. At that time, when you went back, they knew you were going back and you were trying to do your best for the other team that you were playing with. I remember scoring twice at Celtic Park one day, and we could beat 3-2, and I should have scored right at the end of the game, you know. For to have scored the hat trick and got a point, and it was the opening day of the season.
That was the day the flag went up for 79, so it was a beautiful sunny day.
And getting applauded off the park for it, you know. Celtic supporters were always good to me, went back again, you know. There was never anything vitriolic about it.
So you're doing well at Morton. Morton were at their peak around about 79-80. You got the semi final of the League Cup, they got the Scottish Cup semi final one, you'd get beaten early with Rangers. And for a wee while, you were actually top of the league.
That's right.
So, I mean, that was an outstanding Morton team. And the guys like Neil Lord, Joe McLaughlin, Bobby Thompson, they were all good players. Roy Baines was back in goals by that time. So, the point I was trying to make earlier was Hal Stewart was into making money. So why do you think he did the cash in?
Well, at that time...
Because at the point, that what I'm trying to say here is Neil Lord gets his big move to West Ham, Joe McLaughlin gets going to Chelsea, Bobby Thompson gets going to Middlesbrough, and Jim Tomey ended up at Man City via a wee trip out to Belgium. So they're all doing well in their careers. You're Morton's most valuable asset, and yet he stubbornly held on to you.
The big bugbear out of that for me was that Raymond Stewart, who played for Dundee United at the time, had gone during that spell to West Ham, and Ray was a right fullback.
400,000.
440.
For a fullback.
And Hal stated publicly and privately to myself that there was no way he could sell Scotland's best player, who was a top goal scorer, for 200. And He said, "We hold on to you for as long as we need to hold on to you. I'll get £1 million for you," which was just
crazy money, isn't
it? But 13 months after that, Andy Gray moved for £1 million. And that just opened Hull's eyes.
So
the Ian Wallace went down. So the fact that West Ham had spent 440 in a right fullback stopped at that time, anything else. The £200,000, you know, seemingly Liverpool were ready to offer £100,000 just before that, you know, and all of a sudden, Hal was, it was prior to the lottery. Hal might have thought he was on lottery money then, you know. And you look back at it now, and there was a lot of politics attached to it.
Did you ever call the bluff and say, "I want out of here"?
I used to do it every season, because that was really the only tool you had in your armoury as a football player. You know, he spoke to the Daily Record or the Daily Express, and he said to them, "You know, I want to move, and I want to do this, and I want to do that." And basically all it done was piss your own supporters off.
I know.
So I stopped doing that after a wee while and just passed it back on to the hands of people, hoping that at some time sooner or later they would think about it. I had actually the second contract I signed at Morton, that if they got out of the Premier League, I could go. And that was prior to Bosman. And that was as good as Bosman.
Yeah.
You know, because every season, Morton...
They always finish one above it, really, don't they? Well, apart from that one good season.
When that was on the go, and the guys that were getting moves, Hal maybe felt that he could replace them easier, if that's not being nasty to say that. And also as well, eventually when Morton did get relegated and I went to Motherwell with Jock Wallace, they didn't allow me to go to Motherwell until after their batch of season tickets had been sold.
So they could, I know what you mean.
So that people had bought the season tickets.
They weren't going to get a backlash. That's right. There was one point, I mean, Big Jock's the Scotland manager at this point. And again, when you were at your peak at Lorton, there was rumours about getting a cap. So I think the closest you got was under-21s as an overage player.
Yeah.
Did you ever come across Jock at that point?
No.
In Scotland, or it was Eddie Turnbull maybe, or Jim McLean, it was in charge in the days.
Big Jock had came out to watch a game that we played at the end of the season. It was Dundee United, Tannadice, and I think they'd won 2-1. I'd scored a couple of goals and had played well and what have you. And he was being put under pressure by a lot of people, you know. But that had happened previously. I had been informed in 1978 that Alan McLeod was thinking about taking me to Argentina. It was prior to the home international that I would probably get into the 77, 78 home international team and get a few games, Wales and Northern Ireland and England. And it was thinking about taking me to Argentina. They had a committee meeting in the SFA and decided that there was no way that they could take me to Argentina because I was a part-time player. And how would that look to other countries if they were, one of their strikers didn't even play full-time football. He delivered butcher meat, you know. So that became a bone of contention. I spoke to Ali McLeod a few times about it. Ali had said to me, "Andy, if you can get a move to full-time club, better club, whatever, I'll play you. You'll get a game, you know." In fact, I think he broke, for that home international, he broke Derek Johnson for Rangers at that time, who managed to score against, I think it was Wales at Hampden.
Scored twice, didn't he?
And got into the squad, you know. And people said it was because he was with Rangers and I was with Morton, you know. So during all that time, as you can well imagine, I'm trying to get myself a move. But all my pleas and begging was falling upon deaf ears. So, at these times, you basically had to do it. When Big Joke eventually did, he did succumb to including me. He'd included me in the full squad. Now, Scotland were playing at the Heysel on the Wednesday. The under-21s travelled with them because they were playing the same section. They were playing the under-21 Belgian team on the Tuesday, and I travelled out on the Sunday with the full squad. And then when I got there, I landed in Belgian soil. Instead of going to Brussels with the full squad, I was papped on the bus that was going to Ghent with the under-21 squad, and I was told that I was playing. Jim McLean had the under-21s at that time, and I'd be playing with the under-21s with Big Roy, Gordon.
From memory, I think he's won well, hasn't he?
We won, aye. We won.
2-3
Aye, we won. And I came back on the Wednesday up to Brussels, joined the squad again, watched the game in the Heysel, and come back home. Got off at the airport, and we had words again.
Oh, aye.
Which, you know, didn't come across very well. I felt as if, again, he was giving me the proverbial custard pie.
Mm.
And I didn't think I really deserved that. He shouldn't have brought me out there and done all that, because I was having to answer questions to the press about it, you know. Big Joe could say, he'll do what I tell him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically that was the way it was.
So you were famous for not only being a great goal scorer, but you were a scorer of great goals as well. And there's a few that stick in the mind through the years. My father-in-law used to take my brother-in-law down to the Morton games, but he was only a wee boy and you were your Pete. And he always talks about the day that you absolutely roasted Peter Benetti. The Cat, as they called him. He was England international goalkeeper for the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, he ends up at Tannadice, which you wouldn't have thought him and Jim McLean would have been...
good bedfellows.
Oh, you wouldn't have thought that. But that was they reckon that was the last game that he played for Dundee United, and you, it was a hat-trick, Hugo.
Aye, we beat them...
4-1.
4-1.
4-1.
At Capel.
Mm-hmm.
And he had came up with his family to start a new life in Isle of Mull.
Postman.
And Jim had a goalkeeping crisis, and somebody had suggested that Peter, who had only given the game up a couple of months, could get back in and play again, and he come down. And he had been the goal line 70 in the World Cup there.
He was a great keeper.
Chelsea's fantastic. Number one keeper for years. And I managed to play well at Capel that day and score a hat-trick of crazy, mad goals, you know. I think I scored one for the halfway line. Saw him off his line and got the ball in for there. I think I actually scored with Heda that day as well, which would have been a collector's item. And we had played really well. And I think at that time, as you said earlier on, we were a good team. We had good players as well.
The wonderful thing about Morton at the time is that you were the bane of Alec Ferguson's life. Ferguson would come down, he beat Rangers at Ibrox, beat Celtic at Parkhead. And then they go to Capello and get beat 1 or 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a cup tie one, you'll obviously remember the goal, that the long ball got played down, you've took it in the chest, swivelled, flicked to her, I think it was Muller, dribbled by McLeish, and just as it looks as if you've ran out of space, you sort of toe-poked it by on the one flown movement.
Mm-hmm.
That was wonderful.
That was voted as the goal of the season that year, prior to the cup final.
And this was Aberdeen, they were a good team.
They came down to Capello expecting to go on and win the cup that year. And I remember after it, we get wheeled into a wee room at Capello down there for the press and that, and Fergie was a wee bit late on coming in, and he was angry, and we were waiting to come in, and you know, we sat down at the wee table in the chairs, and the gentleman of the press asked a question, you know, to me about the goal. And I babbled on for about 30 seconds about it, and Alec got up, pushed the seat back and said to them, "I'm no listening to this shite anymore. I've got a long journey back up the road to Aberdeen to go." And every time I see him do, or when we meet socially or whatever, you know, I always remind him about it, you know.
He was never a good loser, was he?
Oh, no. I remember he did an interview. I was scouting for Aston Villa at the time, and I was watching a game at Southampton. And Alec had just won the league with Manchester United, and David Beckham had just scored an absolutely fantastic goal. And I come down into the boardroom to have a cup of tea before my long journey back up for Southampton. As you do, you all gather around about the television to see the scores coming. Fergie was getting interviewed, and I was down there myself at Southampton, and I remember him on the telly saying, the goal that Beckham scored. Ah, he said, "I'd seen that before." He says, "There was a guy in Scotland called Andy Ritchie, used to do that all the time to me when I was at Aberdeen." And I remember I had to cut my saucer having a cup of tea at the telly that day. And I wanted to turn around and say to the guy next to me that I was standing next to in the boardroom, "That's me he's talking about." The kid there, you know, I don't know. Maybe I was just too bashful. But I remember thinking, Jesus God, you know. But it reminds me about it all the time as well, you know. He used to do things up at Aberdeen to try and stop me doing things down here that never really worked. So
it's funny how you get that. You just get some teams that are a bogey, and Morton in the days were, but they gave Aberdeen a few.
Football can be like that. You can always get a pain in the arse somewhere, and I think I might have been that for for Alex Ferguson at that time, you know. But they are good players.
Oh, they were a great team.
They were a good team, and we always seem to have a bit of joy when we played against them, you know, and I seem to have a bit of joy personally as well.
Sunlight to moonlight, reflections of my life.
I hope you enjoyed that. I'm sure you did. And as I said at the end of this podcast, the second part of this interview, podcast 247B, will be along very, very shortly. Meantime,
people in trouble, reflections of my life.
As per last season, on the day which I'm sure, for obvious reasons, the club can't say will be Trophy Day, but it will be Trophy Day, there will be a collection for Celtic FC Foundation where you'll get your Celtic badge, and it will be the last game of the season, Sunday, May the 24th. They are looking for volunteers, so if you are interested in helping, collecting, I've done it myself, it's a very uplifting thing to do. CFC Foundation at CelticFC.co.uk. That's CFC Foundation at CelticFC.co.uk. Also, do not forget, and time is running out, if you want to collect your sponsorship money of £125, there is the Ben Nevis Hurdle, Britain's, maybe even be the world's highest hurdle at 4,408 feet, taking place in June. Again, email cfcfoundation at celticfc.co.uk or phone 0141 551 4262. You need to raise a minimum of £125 for the hurdle at the top of Ben Nevis on Saturday, June the 13th. That's why time's running out, because you need a wee bit of time to do that. You do not need to raise £125 to be able to be a bucket collector. Anyway, enough of me. That was him, St. Anthony, with him, Andy Ritchie. This is podcast 247, 247B, with the second half of that Andy Ritchie interview will be along very, very shortly. Good night. Good night.
I'm changing, arranging, I'm changing, I'm changing.